can he manage the 1002 area for wilderness when you don't have the authority to do that?
Senator Dan Sullivan grills the Fish and Wildlife Service over ANWR. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a housing program that helps kids who age out of foster care.
I feel safe, contained. Feel order in my life.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alaska Pacific University offers a distinctive, personalized education grounded in hands-on, real-world experience that prepares graduates to be contributing members and leaders in their communities. This message is sponsored by APU.
The head of the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service this morning appeared before a U.S. Senate committee to defend his budget. Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan took the occasion to question him about the management of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Sullivan says the president is acting illegally.
In Congress, they call it questioning witnesses, but it can sound a lot like verbal pummeling, as it did when Sullivan had his few minutes.
How can the President of the United States, a couple months ago, say he's going to submit a bill to make the 1002 area wilderness, which is fine, he has the right to do that, it's got to be approved here, it won't go anywhere, but then in the meantime say, I'm going to, quote, manage the 1002 area for wilderness anyways. That's what he said on Air Force One. It's a big fanfare.
That was part of Senator Sullivan's question to Dan Ash, director of the Fish and Wildlife Service. Behind it is an assertion Sullivan has been making since January, after President Obama announced he was going to ask Congress to designate new wilderness areas in the Arctic Refuge. Sullivan says the Obama administration also changed how the area would be managed in the meantime. Sullivan says the coastal plain of the refuge, known as the 1002 area, is already being managed as wilderness, the category of highest protection that only Congress can grant. And Congress hasn't granted it. Ash, at times, could barely clear his throat between questions.
How can he manage the 1002 area for wilderness when you don't have the authority to do that? Can you explain that to me? This is a huge issue for my state. And I think you're violating the law. I think the president's violating the law. How do you do that? How do you manage?
We have order. We have order already.
That's Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer jumping in to object to the inquiry style. But the Republican chairman, Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma, cut her off and gave Sullivan more time. The Fish and Wildlife Service says it has not changed its management on the coastal plain of the refuge, an area Alaskan political leaders have been trying to open to oil and gas exploration for decades.
It's managed in an administrative zoning category that we call minimal management.
That's Brian Glasspell, the manager of ANWR, that South Carolina-sized property in the upper right corner of Alaska. Glasspell says the zoning regime has remained the same since 1988.
We did not change our management. The wilderness recommendations for Arctic Refuge don't change how we currently manage any of the recommended areas, including the coastal plain.
As for how minimal management differs from wilderness management, Glasspell acknowledges the differences are administrative with little difference on the ground. But say scientists want to put a weather monitoring station in a refuge. If it's a designated wilderness area, Glasspell says they have to go through a specific analysis to determine if the weather station is necessary for proper management of the area.
It's a fairly onerous process to go through that analysis and documentation. In minimal management, though we similarly strive to maintain the natural conditions of the area. There is no requirement to conduct that kind of analysis.
A spokesman for Sullivan says the service speaks out of both sides of its mouth. He points out that at the hearing, the director of the agency said they manage the 1002 area to protect wilderness value. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Anchorage voters elected Ethan Berkowitz by a wide margin yesterday to be the city's next mayor. The runoff consisted of two candidates from opposite sides of the political spectrum. KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Inside City Hall, Deputy Clerk Amanda Moser oversees a buzzing hive of activity Tuesday evening as volunteers bring in totes full of ballots to be tallied.
How'd it go?
Good. We had over 100 people more than we did in April.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Voter turnout was slightly higher than the regular election in April, rare for a runoff. Results came in fast. About an hour and a half after polls closed, more than 80% of Anchorage's precincts had been counted. They spelled out a decisive win for Berkowitz, who mounted a table inside a popular pizza and pool parlor to give a victory speech. Then a parade of supporters marched a block into Election Central at the Denina Center. Berkowitz says he'll immediately begin assembling a team to build a new administration.
We're going to lay out a plan for that over the next couple of days, but I want to make sure that when I get into office, we're going to have a punch list of items that we want to take care of.
Berkowitz has been in Alaska politics for a while, starting with a decade in the legislature and three unsuccessful bids for state offices. But his biography is a bit of an outlier compared to recent mayors. Originally from San Francisco, Berkowitz went to college at Harvard and came to Alaska to work as a state prosecutor. More recently, he's worked for a consulting firm, but largely stayed out of city politics. Berkowitz beat Chugiak Eagle River Assemblymember Amy Domboski by about 18 percentage points. He thinks one reason for that large margin was the fact that he kept a restrained tone as the race got increasingly hostile.
And on top of that, we had a message that was very positive. When you appeal to people's better angels, you're going to get a better response.
Neither Domboski or her campaign returned calls and messages for comment on the election's outcome. Many who watch city politics believe the race lost its focus on policy and became enmeshed in bizarre personal attacks. Assemblymember Paul Honeyman, himself a former mayoral candidate, said even by Anchorage standards, this race was particularly messy.
I think we've kind of reached a low, kind of a new low in the political machinations that we know of Anchorage politics, and it's not been a real good week.
Before the souring, much of the focus in media and campaign messaging framed the candidates as having different solutions to the same set of problems. In many ways, the issues at the heart of the race, public safety, city budgets, equal rights, education, were fixtures in the current administration of Mayor Dan Sullivan, who endorsed Domboski for her conservative policy plans. Assemblymember L.V. Gray Jackson, a critic of the current administration, says she supports Berkowitz because she sees his style as a reversal.
After 6 years, kind of depression, we're going to have a mayor who cares about our community, who cares about our employees, and really wants to make a difference.
Mayor Sullivan was on hand at Election Central to congratulate Berkowitz and express his support for helping with a smooth transition.
Every department will prepare a report that highlights the issues they're working on, maybe the challenges they're facing, so that he'll be well briefed coming into office. And the good thing is, in the mayor's race, there's about a 2-month period before the new mayor takes over, so it's pretty orderly and generally pretty civil. And I've known Ethan a long time, and we'll have a very nice transition.
The new mayor assumes office on July 1st. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Governor Bill Walker has signed a bill establishing a board to regulate the marijuana industry. The 5-member Marijuana Control Board will issue business licenses for retailers of the drugs, making rules for the cultivation of commercial marijuana and set regulations for the amount of THC in edibles. Applications are currently being accepted for positions on the board. It will be made up of a public safety seat, a public health seat, a rural seat, an industry seat, and another seat that could go to industry or a member of the general public. The board will share staff with the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, but will operate independently. The board is supposed to issue its first retail marijuana licenses next year. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a literary journal that showcases the work of Southeast residents.
It's a way of distinguishing us as a region, that this is a very particular and beautiful and different aspect of the state.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Raven Alaska, connecting Alaskans across the state for more than 50 years. Find more at flyraven.com.
Research shows kids who age out of foster care are less likely to finish high school, find jobs, or go to college. But one organization in Anchorage is trying to change the outcome for former foster kids and other young adults who need to learn the skills to live independently. KSKA's Ann Hillman learned more.
22-year-old Luke Guthrie shows off the sparsely furnished kitchen of the small two-bedroom apartment he shares with a roommate.
This is my cabinet. We both have one side, each of us. That's my cabinet. This is Jesse's. This is our shared table.
He opens the cabinet to show a pile of ramen noodles and other easy-to-cook foods, then heads to the stove to put on a kettle for tea, his fluffy, blazing orange ponytail flowing behind him. He's eager to be polite and welcoming.
Do you guys, like, coordinate someone's duty to do dishes on one day, or?
Yeah, we have a rotation chart, actually, that they provide, the program does.
Guthrie is part of the Living Independent Forever program at Shiloh Community Housing in Anchorage. The program provides low-rent housing for young adults while also teaching them life skills, like learning to live with other people. Guthrie says it was hard at first. He never saw his roommate.
But one night, he just came out and said, hey, man, you want to watch a movie? I was going, all right. And apparently he had a movie I wanted to watch. Can't remember what it was. It was about robots fighting or something like that.
Guthrie grew up in Ketchikan, but moved to Anchorage to go to job training. When he finished, he didn't want to go back to the drama of his family life. But he was young and shy and didn't really have the skills to live on his own. Shiloh Community Housing Executive Director Verna Gibson says many kids end up in the same situation. They come from rough homes or age out of foster care and have nowhere to go. They often don't know what is and isn't acceptable as responsible tenants.
Nobody wants to rent to them. They're not good renters. They don't know all of the rules. They turn their music up too high. They throw trash on the ground.
Gibson says many of her former foster kids had the same problem, and they needed help transitioning into adulthood. So she worked with Shiloh Baptist Church to create the LIFE program back in 2008. They don't provide anything for free. To live in the 8-plex apartment complex, the 14 young people have to start applying for jobs from day one.
The Bible says if you don't work, you don't eat. So they needed to understand that they needed to work to provide for themselves, but they needed the opportunity to be put in a position to increase their skills, get their GED or diploma, and do that in a safe, affordable environment.
The residents also learn about financial literacy, hygiene, interviewing for jobs, showing up to work on time. LIFE program graduate Jessica Steve says the program gave her a safe environment to make mistakes and learn from them. She was fired from a job because she chose to stop showing up.
I knew the policy. I knew what I was doing. So I took that upon myself. I took responsibility for my actions. And that is another thing that Shiloh community has helped me, was take responsibility for yourself.
Now she has new employment with a decent wage and knows that she needs to be responsible. Back at Luke Guthrie's apartment, he comfortably settles into an old used couch in his living room with his cup of tea and smiles at Steve and another resident. The young adults interview each other to make sure they're a good fit before joining the program.
Because this program is like family. We gotta live like a family, help each other.
Each week, the entire group meets together to discuss their issues and their successes. He says this new supportive family has changed his outlook on life.
I feel more confident, more inspired, more outgoing. Before at work, as a janitor at the Fifth Avenue Mall, before, when I saw a homeless guy, I would try to avoid him and stuff. But now, man, I just walk up, I buy a meal sometimes if they're hungry. I just feel like more of a nicer person.
He'll take those strengths and the skills he learned as an electrical apprentice to his new job as well. After acing the application test and the interview, He'll begin as lead electrician for a cruise line railroad this summer. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
With education a hot-button issue in the ongoing budget debate, one school in Sitka is definitely safe this fiscal year. The state-run Mount Edgecombe High School will continue to receive $4.6 million from the Department of Education and Early Development. That money goes directly toward boarding more than 400 students from around the state. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
Dionne Brady is a Mount Edgecombe alumna, class of 1991. And back in February, when the House Finance Subcommittee was talking about what cuts could be made to education, she was surprised that Mount Edgecombe came up. The conversation, led by Representative Lynn Gaddis of Wasilla, essentially asked how much the school costs the state. But the underlying question for many teachers and students was this.
Some of the subtext there was whether or not Mount Edgecombe is even needed anymore at all.
Brady is now a social studies teacher at Mount Edgecombe, and she said her first reaction was denial.
Even as a government teacher who should have been more aware of the possibility that state revenue that's so dependent on oil would decrease, that this school might not exist forever, never occurred to me. And I'll confess that my second, because it's like a second home to me, my second reaction was anger.
Brady took to the Friends of Mount Edgecombe Facebook page, which has nearly 1,000 likes. A network of alumni around the state began making phone calls, writing letters to legislators, and uploading photos of themselves with Brave sweatshirts and Brave hats. Their colors are maroon and gold. Brady said it was a springboard point for lessons in her own classroom.
To kind of show students how government works and how the budget process works, but underclassmen who definitely knew that they wanted to continue their education at Mount Edgecombe were very worried during that time. I think that this just sort of validated what we've been telling them, that it's not an inalienable right for Mount Edgecombe to exist, and that, in fact, we live in a fishbowl and that people are always looking to see whether Mount Edgecombe is doing the job that it's kept open in order to do.
And according to the administration, what the school is trying to do is provide an educational alternative for students around the state, some in rural places with less opportunities. Ayla Reynolds is a new student I met in the cafeteria at the beginning of the school year. She's from Savunga, an island in the Bering Sea.
It's a big world out there, and there's a lot of stuff to do than staying on an island. The same old routine every day on an island. I couldn't vision how it was going to be here because, like, it's a new adventure.
Superintendent Bill Hutton said he's relieved the funding will continue, but with one major hitch. It may not be enough this year to cover the rising cost of operating the residential program at the school. Contracts for dorms and food service, as well as personnel costs, are up.
Flat funding. Flat sounds like it's perfect, but really we have incremental increases in expenditures, and so we have to cut in order to be prepared for those.
Also of major concern for Hutton is how much money the school receives per student enrolled. The legislature proposed a cut of 1.1%, which translates into $46,000 less for Mount Edgecombe. If that figure survives the special session, it will leave the school, and likely many others, with a deficit.
As of right now, we're about $225,000 short for next year.
To prepare, Hutton is planning to purchase a minimum of school supplies, reduce travel for student activities, and to keep 2.5 open teaching positions empty. But much is up in the air. Hutton's experience speaks to the odd dichotomy many superintendents are finding themselves in as they await the final budget, to plan for a financial future with a foggy crystal ball. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Mm-hmm. One of Seward's city-owned sewage lagoons is currently drained and non-functioning, according to a city schedule for maintenance, and that has caused a problem. On Tuesday, the Seward City News reported litter being washed up on a local beach at high tide. The trash consists of small bits of cardboard packaging, some plastic individual condiment containers, and cigarette butts. The debris is thought to be coming from Spring Creek Prison. Sewage headed for the unused lagoon is supposed to be collected and trucked away, but some of it is escaping a primary screening process, according to Seward City Executive Liaison Jackie Wild.
We assume that the debris came from Spring Creek, but it's condiment packages that haven't been used at the facility for some time. They are not that biodegradable, and during the sludge remover process, they got stirred up and made it through the screens that were on the pump and ended out on a fallout line.
The city organized a cleanup plan Tuesday and is currently taking measures to mitigate the problem.
The city public works has 4 people on the beach cleaning right now, along with 6 people that are at the lagoon itself cleaning. And Spring Creek's actually been very cooperative and has helped people on their site also.
Cleaning efforts can only take place at low tide. The trash washed up on 4th of July Beach, and some is caught on a fence around the sewage lagoon. The Spring Creek Prison has a sewage outlet pipe near the beach. Sherry Daigle, spokesperson for the State Department of Corrections, says minimum security inmates are helping with the cleanup. Russ Maddox is a Seward resident who is active in environmental matters. Maddox says he was alerted to the mess yesterday.
Apparently somehow they overflowed or some sewage or wastewater passed through without being filtered out, and unfortunately it covered the beach right there. And so we went back out this morning hoping that the city would be cleaning it up, and sure enough they were out there starting a cleanup. And we checked it out, it was low tide, so we could see it was all spread out through the intertidal zone. And the tidal lagoon, there's a tidal pool right at the mouth of Spring Creek, and the bottom of it is littered with this debris as well underwater.
The State Department of Environmental Conservation has been notified and is sending a site inspection team. The latest edition of the University of Alaska Southeast literary journal Tidal Echoes was released recently. It takes a year to curate all of the work that goes into the book, which showcases poets, fiction writers, and artists. There's only one requirement for submission. You have to be a full-time resident of Southeast. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more on capturing the region's unique cultural identity in print.
Emily Wall flips through 114 map pages of the freshly published journal.
I think that's a photograph. That's 3D art made out of an egg carton.
Wall is the faculty advisor for Tidal Echoes, which is now in its 8th year. The journal is edited by UAS students. It accepts work from all over Southeast, from the Lemon Creek Correctional Center to Metlakatla. Wall says there are no themes. It's more about creating a platform for local artists and writers.
And so I really like that for Down South audiences, it's a way of distinguishing us as a region, that this is a very particular and beautiful and different aspect of the state.
There are other literary journals in Alaska. Some accept submissions from out of state, but none are regionally specific. In this edition of Tidal Echoes, the featured writer and artist are both from Juneau. The cover has Fumi Matsumoto's artwork on it, a collection of used tea bags stamped with ravens.
It's a happy cover, you know what I mean? someone said that, too. They said, oh, yeah, all the ravens look like they're having a good time. Oh, look at this. And I found this baseball guy that's made out of, I guess he's part of a trophy, but...
Matsumoto is a found artist who's lived in Alaska for about 30 years. You might look at an empty milk carton or the dying leaves of a houseplant and see trash. Fumi thinks of something else.
Here's the leaves. The image of a wolf sort of popped out of the pile of leaves. It's almost like a puzzle, then looking for the right leaf to make the ear. That's what I like to do. If I find something and you look at it for a while, a piece of driftwood or whatever, and what kind of images come out, you know, as you're staring at it.
There was the time she noticed the glint of a pile of Mountain Dew cans.
And I don't drink it. I just had the cans. And I thought, wow, the colors were really nice. You've got the green and the red.
she realized the colorful aluminum looked like the feathers of her bird, Pogo.
Very parrot-like. So I just made parrots out of those.
Matsumoto is Japanese-American and uses different Eastern techniques for her art. Origami, kirigami or paper cutting, sumi, which is inkbrush painting. Some of her work is playful, like the Mountain Dew parrots. Other pieces tell the story of her family history, like Minidoka Interlude.
It's a very subtle photo of a Japanese woman in a kimono, and that's my mom.
The photograph is encased in a square metal cage.
There's a gold button, barbed wire, and a scroll that has the name of some of the Japanese internees there.
Minidoka refers to the Idaho internment camp that Japanese Americans were sent to during World War II. Matsumoto's father and relatives were sent to a different location. At the time, the U.S. government feared another attack like Pearl Harbor, but little evidence was ever uncovered to support theories of espionage.
It's just that we look like the enemy, you know? If we hadn't looked like Japanese people, I doubt if they would have been rounded up and stuck in camps.
Matsumoto says she didn't learn about her family's past until she was older. As far as her dad explaining to her what happened?
Well, he didn't. That was a thing. Most Japanese Americans were basically wanting to put it behind them. You know, it was very shameful to have been accused of being a spy or unloyal because they weren't.
Her father left the internment camp for the U.S. Army and went on to be a highly decorated war hero. Matsumoto says she hopes making artwork like this will help create a dialogue.
Then perhaps people will become aware and sensitive, you know, to what had happened and that it won't happen again.
You can see Fumi Matsumoto's work in the latest edition of Tidal Echoes, along with other pieces from Southeast artists and writers. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes, Ellen Lockyer, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Emily Kwong in Sitka, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez also reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059. Alaska Children's Trust, working to prevent child abuse and neglect by encouraging all Alaskans to take small steps that can make a big difference in the lives of Alaska's children. Information at alaskachildrenstrust.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Graduate with work-ready experience in the career field of your choice. Apply now for fall 2015. Find out more about APU's promised tuition grant and other scholarships at alaskapacific.edu. This message is sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.